You're listening to the Pop and Lock Report at popandlock.net, a part of the Unshackled Network. So welcome to Convict History. This is a bit of a bonus show to the regular Pop and Lock Report. Here we'll be discussing important and defining pieces of Australian history. For now, we'll be looking at events in a This Week in History kind of format, though we do expect later we'll be doing episodes focusing on particular Australian historic figures and going a bit more in depth into things that took place over a long time. This week, I've got with me Jacob Long of the Australian Traditionalist. You can check out his page on Facebook. Say g'day to everyone, Jacob.
G'day, how you going?
I've also got with me Michael Smythe, the political editor of theunshackled.net. Say hello, Michael.
Hello.
He's got a bit of a husky voice this week. And I've also got with me Lucas Rosas, who is also a contributor of The Unshackled. Lucas does some great work in Antifa watching and keeping an eye on anarchist groups. Say hello, Lucas.
Hello.
So, on the 10th of October 1912, the Australian federal government, the newly formed federal government, of course, because we were federalised in 1901, the Australian government introduced a £5 allowance for married and single women who gave birth, which at that time was equivalent to about 2 weeks' worth of wages for a family. The Barrier Minor, a Broken Hill newspaper, wrote at the time, this was in August 1912, so about 2 months before it came in, quote, "The gift is not intended to be one in the form of charity, but a recognition by the Commonwealth of its duty to take some part in the raising of that population of which it stands in so much need." Michael, did you want to take us through this?
Absolutely. Now, this is amongst the first, if not the first, social welfare programs introduced in the entire world, along with being one of the first nations to introduce universal suffrage for women. In 1902, we also had the Maternity Allowance Act, which had two motivations. One, to decrease the infant mortality rate, and also, which is much less discussed, to improve the fertility rates of white European Australians. Because in the Maternity Allowance Act, they actually excluded Indigenous, Asian, and Pacific Islander heritage women.
Yeah, it's quite a generous allowance, and it's universal in the sense that, not like you just said, it wasn't universal racially, but it was universal in the sense that it wasn't, unlike current welfare, it wasn't tied to your actual earnings or current stature.
That's right.
It was purely to promote childbirth.
Exactly, and to ensure that immediate postnatal care was provided to people, because the fertility rate amongst the mortality rate rather amongst male babies was 8%, amongst female babies it was 6.3%. I don't know why it was higher for males than it was for females, but that's the way it was. And, of course, the Australian government wanted to increase the population, particularly the white population of Australia.
Yeah.
There was opposition to it from some of the more conservative religious groups who objected to it being given to unmarried women. Hmm. They thought it was a...
encouragement to sin.
Yes, but there was also support on the same Christian premise, people arguing that it is an act of Christian charity to give to these people. So it was a bit of a mess in that regard.
Yeah, it's interesting the revisionist kind of history that goes on, and I guess this is a large point of why I wanted to start this podcast, just kind of talking about Australian history from a non-PC revisionist history lens, because a lot of what you get in schooling is you'll view this from a very sort of binary, oh, the conservatives thought this and the progressives thought this. which is not really an accurate reflection of what was going on.
No, exactly right. There was a lot more complication than, you know, what you might get taught at school. I mean, as for me, all I knew is that Fisher brought in the Maternity Allowance Act. I didn't understand why it was brought in, what the motivations behind it. It's just something you get taught. Oh, in 1912, Andrew Fisher did this. But they don't often explain in the school, in the syllabus, why something is done. They just said, oh, this was done. Move on. You know, it's like a footnote. But looking through it, it's a lot more interesting to see what the motivations were. Well, bearing in mind,
yes.
Especially when you can look at from, because obviously back then we were homogenous culturally and homogenous religiously, and so you can see where Christianity split.
Yeah, exactly. It was extremely nuanced in support. I mean, there was Christians on both sides, and then there was people on the side in favor who favored, you know, increasing white birth rates and incentivizing white birth over indigenous birth. So it was extremely nuanced. It wasn't black and white. It wasn't just left and right. What's interesting also is that there was a very personal motivation behind it. I mean, I'm reading here in the Australian National Museum that Fisher had worked in the mines in Queensland for some time, and he knew many people personally who were unable to afford the necessities of caring for a new baby. So he proposed a maternity payment, which would allow working mothers to spend time with their new child without placing excessive strain on family income. So it was very personal as well. It wasn't just an issue pushed by any groups or anything.
And I think it's worth pointing out that Andrew Fisher was Australia's first Labor Prime Minister.
Yeah.
And that it was his time in the mines. And it was that Labor Party at that stage was explicitly a racial nationalist party. It's what they were after. The Section 6 of this particular act, if you read it out, it says no Asiatics, no Aboriginal, no Pacific Islander women may accept this in any way, shape or form. It was explicitly not about a eugenic policy of making people better and culling the poor like a lot of policies in Europe at that time. It was explicitly about race. And that's a really interesting thing in history because it's like what I said, we don't get taught that in school. We don't get taught that the Labor Party was essentially founded back in the 1890s of the Shearer strike as an explicitly racialist
sort of party. That was a pretty big red pill for me, was going back and realizing, you know, you get a lot of talk about the White Australia policy in contemporary politics, but the White Australia policy, the Labor Party was basically formed for the White Australia policy.
Yes, it was, because it's about the rights of the workers.
Yeah.
And overseas workers coming in were...
I mean, anyone who's spent any time in North Queensland knows about blackbirding as well, and about how that was a major thing that the Labor Party was against. It was against bringing in Pacific Islanders to take jobs that could be used by white men up in North Queensland.
Yes, and, the sugarcane slaves were especially significant in that.
Yeah, it was a huge thing. They didn't want the big sugarcane farmers to be able to bring in sort of Pacific Island slaves, well, indentured servants, who under extremely strenuous contracts. Then they wanted them to actually use white labourers for that purpose. Of course, the big sugarcane farmers, as soon as the Immigration Restriction Act came in, immediately turned around and imported massive amounts of Italians.
Well, regardless, I mean, the party did aim, I suppose, to benefit workers, and I think that the racial aspect was more of a byproduct of that.
All right, so that's the 1912 maternity allowance. So... moving on to the next topic we've got. On the 12th of October 2002, the Bali bombings occurred, which were a bombing in Bali, Indonesia, obviously. They killed 202 people, 88 of whom were Australians, and it wounded hundreds more. And this was the single biggest terror attack, the single biggest loss of life of Australians incurred in a terror attack ever. And obviously this came only a year after 9/11. I was quite young at the time. I was only about 6 or 7, and Jacob and I are late 90s kids, but you guys, Lucas and Michael, you guys would have memories of this, of being older and seeing this on TV. Do you want to talk about this a bit?
Well, what I basically, because I was I was only 16 in 2002, so I was still relatively young. But I remember seeing the news coverage and thinking to myself, this is horrible. And my uncle was, well, you can imagine his reaction, what his reaction might be, knowing that some Muslim terrorists had blown up the Kuta Club and another club in Bali. It was just a shock. It was, you know, it was a realization that, you know, we've got terrorists next door who want to make war on our way of life. I mean, you know, September 11, 2001, okay, that was pretty bad. That was extremely bad, but it was still far away.
It wasn't close to home for us, yeah.
It didn't hit us close to our hearts because it was half a world away. But Bali is just next door. I mean, if you live in Brisbane,
oh yeah,
it's closer to Brisbane than Perth. It's a shorter flight from Brisbane to Bali than it is from Brisbane to Perth, and it hits you a lot more because it's a lot closer to the eastern seaboard. And people were very upset. People were angry. People were afraid. To be fair, the TNI and the Indonesian police, they did their they were quite quick in their response, but that didn't stop the attack in the first place.
Yeah, so just for anyone listening from outside Australia, Bali is basically one of our biggest tourism hotspots. It's basically where Australians go for cheap holidays. I'm trying to think what would be the equivalent to America.
Well, it's pretty much a party island, so
yeah.
I'd say for Americans, Cabo, sort of a cheap place you go to get drunk, which has cheap beer and lots of sunshine, that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
But probably about a similar distance from continental United States as well.
Mm. Yeah.
So I'm just going to play this clip, which was, this is an ABC, our public broadcaster, interviewing John Howard. This is from, I think it was 2012 or 2013 that they did this interview with him, and it's basically just asking him about how he remembers it and his response and what he thinks of his response in hindsight.
John Howard was Prime Minister at the time. His reaction to the crisis is seen by many as one of his finest moments as Prime Minister, and he spoke to ABC News about the devastating impact that terrorist attack had on all Australians.
This was a major a tragedy and a terrible attack, and of course it's something that rocked our country to its very core.
What was your personal reaction to it?
Well, one of horror that this should happen in a place that people saw almost as part of Australia, to people who were doing the most natural thing in the world, having a good time. But I thought immediately then, what have we got to do? Because in my situation, the immediate concern was to helping the people who were injured, and the great thing that immediately swung into action was an enormous cooperative effort.
In a way, was it almost as though this attack had happened on Australian soil, given that Bali was so popular with Australian tourists?
It was very much like an attack on our home soil, very much. Bali was close, inexpensive, accessible, popular. This was the end of the football season. You remember the names of all of those football clubs? Coogee Dolphins, Kingsley, Sturt, so the names will forever be associated with the Bali attack. And I felt that a lot of Australians saw it as if it had been an attack on Australia.
How did the attacks change Australia's relationship with Indonesia? And was there the chance that perhaps it could have driven a wedge between the two countries?
Oh, it could easily have done that, and I have no doubt that if the thought had crossed the minds of the murderers, they would have wanted to push us further apart, but it had the opposite effect. It brought us closer together, and it brought me and others into contact with Bung Bung Yudhoyono, who would then in time become the president and who is very pro-Australian. One of the positive things, if you can look for positives out of such a terrible tragedy, was that Australia and Indonesia learnt the value of cooperating to fight terrorism.
But you maintain the view today that Australia's involvement in the so-called war on terrorism has not made the country more vulnerable to terrorism.
I don't believe it has. No, I don't hold that view. I hold the view that the reason why we're a terrorist target is that we're a free, open, liberal Western democracy. the view that had been put to us by the intelligence was that we would have been a target anyway, or could have been a target anyway, irrespective of positions we took on Afghanistan and Iraq. But if the people who planned this atrocity imagined for a moment that it was going to drive Indonesia and Australia apart, they fail completely, because Indonesia and Australia have come together as a result, and the cooperation is much greater than it was before October of 2002.
So clearly it's very much just the sort of standard boomerist, globalist response. What, give us your thoughts on this. Any of you have any takes?
Yeah, it's very interesting to note the effect on tourism and on our relationship with Indonesia that this has had. I mean, Howard said in part of his speech there, the spirit remains strong, free, open, and tolerant. So it's a very interesting response. And we're getting to that time in 2018 when there are people such as myself who was 2 years old at the time. I obviously have no recollection of the events unfolding on news, who obviously have no memory of the Bali bombings, who are now at that age where they can actually tour over to Bali and visit the party island. And it seems it hasn't really damaged our tourism to Bali. I mean, one Australian dies there every 8 days, yet we still see it as the number one cheap destination.
Yeah, you're 100% right there. It's really quite interesting that it... look, little Johnny, he got a lot of things wrong in that speech, but he was very boomer-tier, but he also got a lot of stuff right. And, yeah, it's interesting, particularly because you say, Jacob, you're saying you're 2 years old at the time, or Michael's saying 16. I was 19 at the time, and a lot of the things that Michael say really sort of come through with me. I mean, there was a lot of fear at the time. There was a lot of sort of people were very sort of upset. It was a year after September 11. People forget how peaceful the 90s were, and we were all living through this wonderful, incredible age of peace and prosperity and plenty and all that sort of stuff. And then
so-called end of history.
Crash and, yeah, the end of history, Francis Fukuyama. And then it all came crashing down to an end just in a couple of years, just as sort of we were reaching adulthood. I mean, a lot of guys I know who were my age at the time ended up serving in Afghanistan and serving in East Timor. And a lot of the reason why they joined up in the first place was things like Bali. I know a lot of, I've met a few American guys over the journey who ended up joining the US military because of September 11. I think that Bali may have had a similar effect for Australians.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, 88 is a pretty significant number. So there's a lot of people who knew someone who was affected or even someone who died in those attacks.
Well, look, I remember a couple of years later, a few of the people who their family members had been injured at Kuta that night, they ended up on the beach at Cronulla just a couple of years later. An interesting part of Australian history that doesn't really, the sort of cause and effect of that doesn't really come through. It was only a couple of years. It was 3 years almost exactly between the Bali bombings and the Cronulla riots in Sydney.
I think it's interesting to note also just how ignorant Western governments were towards this very close threat. So if you go, the group that carried out the attack is called Jemaah Islamiyah, Jemaah being J-E-M-A-A-H, and then Islamiyah being the word Islam, I-Y-A-H. If you go on their Wikipedia page, you can have a look at a timeline of just them sort of ramping up to this. And it basically starts in early 2000. Three members were arrested in Manila carrying plastic explosives in their luggage. 17th of August 2000, Jemaah Islamiyah attempted to assassinate the Philippine ambassador to Indonesia. Bomb detonated as his car entered his official residence in central Jakarta, killing two people and injuring 21 others, including the ambassador. 13th of September 2000, a car bomb explosion tears through a packed parking deck beneath the Jakarta Stock Exchange building, killing 15 people and injuring 20. December 2000, this is Christmas Eve. The organization took part in a major coordinated terror strike, the Christmas Eve 2000 bombings. 30th of December the same year, a series of bombings occurred around Metro Manila in the Philippines. 22 died and over 100 were injured. 5th of June 2002, Indonesian authorities arrest Kuwaiti Omar al-Farouk handed over to the US authorities. He subsequently confesses he is a senior al-Qaeda operative sent to Southeast Asia to orchestrate attacks against US interests. He reveals to investigators detailed plans of a new terror spree in Southeast Asia. After many warnings by US authorities of a credible terrorist threat in Jakarta on 23rd of September 2002, a grenade explodes in a car near the residence of a US embassy official in Jakarta, killing one of the attackers. September, there's a travel warning urging Americans and Westerners in Indonesia to avoid locations such as bars, restaurants, and tourist areas. 2nd of October 2002, a US soldier and two Filipinos are killed in a nail bomb attack outside a bar. And then even 2 days before this attack that we're talking about, a bomb rips through a bus terminal in the southern Philippine city of Kidapawan, killing 6 people and injuring 24. On the same day, the US ambassador in Jakarta, Ralph Boyce, personally delivers to the Indonesian president a message of growing concern that Americans could become targets of terrorist attacks in her country. So it's... I mean, maybe I shouldn't say that...
And we were clueless. No, yeah. That was the thing. We were clueless.
Yeah, I mean...
As someone who was an adult at this time, I was 18, I was 19 at the time, we never heard about any of this. We never heard about it in the news. We never heard about it on the TV. Look, this was before widespread internet as well. There was quite a bit of internet around, but it wasn't anywhere near the level that we have today. All right, we genuinely didn't know about what was happening in the country that's next door to us. That's why it came as such a huge shock to people. And look, after this, a lot of people, including myself, ended up looking into a lot of what happened with JI in Indonesia and a lot of the history of that, if I can go into a little bit of a deep dive on
that
right now.
Yeah, go for it.
JI in Indonesia, Islam in Indonesia has always been a bit of a strange thing because most places in the world where Islam has come, it has come through conquest, whereas Indonesia is one of the few places that came through trade. And religion in general in Indonesia has nearly always been a syncretic thing. Right. First they had the animism and then they mixed it with Hinduism that they got through trade from India. And then they mixed it with Buddhism that they got through trade from India as well. And then came Islam along the journey as well. And it was pretty much the same sort of thing over and over again. And basically they just sort of mixed it all together. There was never sort of the purest Islam that has come from many other different places around the world. It's always sort of been a mixture of they took down the Hindu statue of Ganesh, replaced it with a statue of Buddha, then took down the statue of Buddha and turned it into a Sufi shrine, that sort of a thing. It's never really been a purist thing, except in Aceh, which is a bit of a sort of a strange historical case. So what happened during independence was that you had a lot of Islamist groups rose up in Aceh and in a few other places where Islamism was strong. And they sort of contributed to the independence struggle. Most of the independence movements in Indonesia were communist or were nationalist in some form or another. But in just a few places, they were Islamist. And those are the seeds that eventually created JI. There were Darum Islam back then. I think one of the militias fighting against the Japanese and against the Dutch was actually called Hezbollah, which is the first mention I've ever found of Hezbollah anywhere. So they might have been the originals. And but for most people in Indonesia, all right, the Hindu temple may have turned into a Buddhist monastery, may have turned into a mosque, but didn't really change anything. You still worshipped the ancestors. You still went and did the same things over and over again. But post-independence, people started, middle-class Javanese in particular, started going on the Hajj. And when they were coming back from the Hajj, they had all these new ideas that they brought with them from Arabia and the new kingdom of Saudi Arabia, which had just started up there. And they started sort of really teaching and emphasizing the Islamist values, which helped groups like JI to suddenly grab an audience that they'd never really had before. Now, JI assumed that with these terrorist attacks in Bali and with all these other terrorist attacks that you mentioned, that this was part of the global struggle for the Ummah, for the Islamic community, and that with this struggle and with all these attacks that they were doing, they would inspire their people, who are all nominally Muslim, to rise up against foreign influences and that sort of stuff. But as you heard from the John Howard clip, that never really happened. JI actually got more unpopular because of these attacks with the Muslim population of Indonesia. They completely misjudged their target audience. They completely misjudged the people that they were trying to appeal to. And that really sort of killed them off eventually. They still have their bases of support. They still have small bases of support today, but it's they never really managed to create the revolution that they were looking for. And this sort of you can see similarities with communist and anarchist propaganda of the deed and the years of lead in Italy, where people get a little bit exaggerated. They think a revolution is just around the corner and they decide to blow stuff up. And that's what happened a bit with the JI guys. And that's why 88 Australians, I think it was people from 20 other nationalities as well, ended up dying. And, yeah, ultimately it was counterproductive for them. It was deadly for us. It helped us bring us a little bit closer to Indonesia, but the Indonesians are never going to like us. So ultimately a lot of people died for no really good reason.
That's exactly right. And I think a lot of people not exactly aware of just how tense relations have been between Jakarta and Canberra ever since the late 1990s. Because while Paul Keating was a very close friend of former President Suharto, John Howard was, well, he was not so friendly towards Suharto for good reason. And then when the East Timor crisis came up, when the Indonesians decided to do yet another routine slaughter of the East Timorese, the Australian government said, look, enough is enough. This can't go on. And what is not perhaps known, sorry, Jack, I'm going to go into a bit of a divergence.
Go ahead.
In regards to East Timor, the Indonesian-backed local pro-government militias were attacking and murdering and raping and doing all the horrible things that happen in wars. And they were looking at shooting. There were times when they were actually looking at shooting at Australian Armed Forces personnel when it came to the organization of the referendum on independence versus autonomy. The Americans, to their credit, actually called the Indonesians and said, if you hit one Australian soldier, we will come down on you like a bag of hammers. And the Indonesians have always been resentful of us ever since we, and to a lesser extent, the Americans guaranteed the independence of East Timor. The next thing that comes from my earlier point is that Luke is right in pointing out that Indonesian Islam is very syncretic. I mean, Indonesians tend to be Indonesian first and Islamic second. But with the return of educated middle-class Javanese, especially from the Hajj, that is the pilgrimage to Mecca, the Saudis have also exported Wahhabism to Indonesia. So the groundswell of antipathy towards Western liberal values has been steadily increasing for a very long time. And most of the people don't care, but the people in power are starting to take a more, a more aggressive and less tolerant approach to any encroachment of Western values upon the Pancasila, though that is the five pillars of Indonesian society.
Is that how you pronounce it? I always get it wrong.
Oh, it's either Pancasila.
Pancasila.
I think technically...
It's the story of...
Yeah, I think technically both are correct because Pancha is the Sanskrit and Panka is...
The story of how that came about is really sort of interesting, just the idea that when the independence forces all came together, you had the communists, you had the nationalists, and you had the Islamists, and they needed an ideology to go to independence without immediately having a civil war, so they just decided to have all of the ideologies. And called it Pancasila or however you pronounce it.
I'm actually curious, and sorry to change the subject so abruptly, but I'm curious to know how you feel to Chris Evans' response on the 10th anniversary of the attacks in 2012, when he said, quote, "They took many lives, but they failed in their mission." October 12th of 2002 was also a day of great heroism, of selfless acts of courage, of remarkable emergency response.
And obviously he's thanking the emergency response there, which is a great thing to do, and it's pretty much obligatory. But how is that perceived when he says they took many lives, but they failed in their mission, when his response is also coupled with inaction on part of the Australian government?
Well, yeah, and the group, the JI group, is also strongly suspected of carrying out several other terror attacks in years to come. So there was a 2002 bombing in Kuningan, Jakarta, 2004 Australian embassy bombing in Jakarta, 2005 Bali terrorist bombing, and 2009 JW Marriott and Ritz-Carlton hotel bombings. So for all, you know, for all John Howard's patting himself on the back for bringing the two countries together and having us cooperate, have we really seen real material differences in terms of the threat?
Yeah, see, I understand that obviously leaders have to unite their people and, you know, maintain the Australian spirit and ensure that their country's spirit isn't broken and everything. But it just doesn't go down well when it's coupled with inaction.
The relationship between Australia and Indonesia is a really, really weird one. We try to pretend like we get along. We don't actually have all that much in the way of trade links, which is really quite surprising considering how close we are to each other. We did get caught spying on their president and his wife's phones for the Americans through the Five Eyes project too recently, which wouldn't have helped. It's more like friendly enemies rather than anything else. But in the way, from the Indonesian perspective, the JI attacks on Bali and that sort of stuff, it wasn't really all that much to do with Australia or with the foreigners as well, except the fact that it might have pissed off the Americans. It was more it's internal ructions within their own society, right? The Islamism part of the Islamism, socialism, nationalism combine was getting a bit too excited, a bit too inspired by people coming out of the Middle East and decided to throw their weight around a little bit, and they needed to get shoved down hard. And the presidents post that have done that to a greater or lesser extent, as much as you can do anything from central authority in Indonesia, which is pretty difficult. But they stamped down on Aceh eventually, which was trying to get sort of Islamist independence. They've sort of worked out their internal sort of problems. As far as Australian-Indonesian relationships went, bit of a sideshow, not really the main event.
Do you know what this state of this Jamaah Islamiyah group is now? I mean, there's nothing here sort of past 2014 or 2015 at the latest, and they were a Al-Qaeda and Taliban-linked group, which obviously they have somewhat faded into obscurity for against the even more aggressively violent threat of ISIS.
They had one good bomb maker, which they got from who was Al-Qaeda trained in Afghanistan. I forget his name. I probably couldn't pronounce his name. They had one good bomb maker who came out. He trained a few other good bomb makers, and that's where they got a lot of their stuff from. Once they managed to crack down on those guys, there wasn't a lot more to them. They ended up with splinter groups. Their main leaders and ideological figureheads went to jail, and it's sort of they calmed down. They decided, as with a lot of Islamic groups throughout Western countries and even inside Islamic countries, they decided to try to advance their causes by means other than blowing people into small pieces.
Yeah, this is from the Telegraph, a 2014 report from the Telegraph alleges that the Al-Qaeda groups all in various areas, their influence is declining as the ISIS influence rises, which is, it's just kind of funny because it's one Islamic group out-Islaming the other.
Oh, yeah. Have an episode on Syria one time and we'll see.
Yeah, we will. Keen to go into that. All right, well, I guess we'll wrap it up. So we hope you enjoyed this episode of Convict History. Don't forget to check out popandlock.net for more analysis and commentary from us. Thank you to The Unshackled for letting us use their platform. Check out their coverage at theunshackled.net. Thanks for tuning in. Take care of each other, and we'll see you next week.